Joseph.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen, so you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for a free trial. And welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz here, and it is episode 115. It is the depths of summer. Oh boy, it seems like it is down here in Florida. It's like 100 degrees in the shade, and it's humid, and I don't have to tell you about all the things that are going on. How are you doing? How are you doing? I mean, the market is throwing a lot of curveballs here, so much so that I'll tell you something, folks. You looked at me for a long time. You say, wow, what is going on here? And I'm telling you, you know, we have good, we have bad. It's confusing even to the pros. I had a long discussion with many people this week. I spent some time kind of cultivating some of my pro friends and said, you know, what is going on? What are you doing? They're saying, hey, man, this is miserable. This is like, some of them called it the meat grinder, you know, because one day you see it going down, one day you see it going up. And, you know, I'll give you an example. This week, what happened this week, right? So Monday, we had a great market day on the downside. What I mean great is just, you know, a big. So we had this big, gigantic, just incredible move on the downside. And then all of a sudden, it looked like all of the indicators were starting to crash through, right? We broke the 200-day on most major indices. A lot of stocks got pummeled. I mean, we saw the materials companies just get walloped. I mean, down 15% for the day. And it looked like things were starting to take the foot off the pedal a little bit, and people were starting to react to what was going on and the realization of earnings and the realization of fundamentals and the realization of where the markets were and where they've been. And some of the realization, frankly, about some of the things we're seeing in the news. The economics were quite horrible this week, except for one or two numbers. But then all of a sudden, on Wednesday and Thursday, Friday, it was like, what happened? Actually, not Friday, but Wednesday and Thursday, this giant move up, even though we saw a really bad economic number with concern to regarding the payroll numbers or the unemployment situation, it seems that people were just giddy about maybe the PCE, or maybe it was, or possibly the overall level of GDP being adjusted. Who knows? But you know what? It's a problem, because if you're trying to play a long short, if you're trying to be short at all, if you're trying to be long at all, you know, if you went into the week long, you got really hurt. If you went into the week short, you got really hurt. That's what is going on right now. And if you went into the week short and long, you got hurt too. So there's no happy medium. This is no happy medium. And right now, it's frustrating, and I understand it. One of the things that we do when we get frustrated, folks, is we kind of sit back for a second. You know, don't do anything drastic. Don't chase anything. See how things play out. See if we get a signal. See if it turns around in the upside, the downside. Watch your individual positions. Keep your stops tight. And, you know, just be very, very careful, because this is where we get very dangerous. Now, I'm not predicting it going up. I'm not predicting it going down right now. But I will tell you something. There are probably reasons why I would say that both are possible. On an individual basis, stocks, you know, can go up. You know, some good stocks that are in the right area. We like the cash for clunkers area as an example, and I put that up on the last podcast. There's some areas that I think are awful, overdone. One of the things that we made a very big mistake on last week was we had Green Mountain Coffee. We were short. We were up 10% on Monday. By Thursday, we were flat to down. And by Friday, we were off by 4 or 5%, and we cut our position and said, you know what, this is just not operating correctly. It may come back to us, and we may get back into it again, but I got to tell you something. It is the most frustrating position to be in when things are flying around 15, 20% in a week. It's ridiculous. That's not something you really should be involved in as an investor. If you want to buy and hold, fine, have a good time. But me, as an investor that looks at things and says, you know what, where are the bargains, where are the values, I'm not seeing a lot of them right now per se, because the values and the bargains can get hurt when the market, you know, gets crushed as well. Again, either the up or the down, short or long. So anyway, what I thought we'd do today is we'd bring an old friend by. His name is Harry Dent, and he is a good person to listen to about the long term. And I thought that I'd ask him some questions about, you know, what's going on with the market, what's going on with the economy, what's going on with the global situation. Is it as good as we're seeing it in Asia? Is it, you know, good in India? What's going on? So I thought I would ask him some questions about that and bring it to him. And we are going to start with that in a second. But if you have any questions you want to ask me, we've got some good ones that were lined up recently. Just write to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'm going to keep it short and sweet today because I think it's important that we hear from Harry. I want to ask him some in-depth questions about what's going on. So stick around. We get back. We'll be on with Harry Dent on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Stick around. We'll be right back. And back by popular demand, we're here with Harry Dent, who recently wrote a bestseller. And we'll get to that in a second. And he's been on this program very often and a good friend of mine. We recently had some lunch together. Harry, how are you?
Good, Andrew.
Listen, so how's the book doing, by the way?
You know, it's doing good. It sold the most when the markets were crashing in January, February, March, right, as usual. And then we expect to do very well this fall and next year when we see the next crash.
So the book is called, just so everybody knows, you got to get it. It's a great, great read. And his other books. I fell in love with Harry's work back. When did you write the original Great Boom Ahead? What year was that?
That came out in late 1992.
Right. So I have that. I think I've told you this before. Every page is dog-eared and highlighted. But his latest book is The Great Depression Ahead. And it's a great read. I think you should pick it up. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about what's going on, because we've had the concept of depression. People are saying that depression's off the table. We're in a recession. They're saying the recession is ending. We have green shoots. We don't have green shoots. A la, you know, Buffett says no green shoots just a couple of days ago. And, you know, the guys from PIMCO said the same thing. But yet we're seeing this market really rally. It's faltering. What's going on?
Well, again, we have made, every 40 years approximately, we make major tops in stock markets, 29, 68, and now 2007. You know, we originally thought it could be as late as 2008 or 9, but clearly with this first crash, I mean, this is a major top. This is the peaking of the largest generation in U.S. and Western history spending cycle. It's also the beginning of the deleveraging of the most massive debt buildup and leveraging in the history of mankind, or at least back to the 1720s, when that South Seas bubble burst way back then. So this is a, we said from the beginning, even though our book's called The Great Depression Ahead, we said, look, the first phase will be a deep recession. The government will stimulate. You'll get a bounce, but it will not last, because the baby boomers are going to continually move more towards savers now, not spenders. They've been scared to death now that their stock and retirement plans have been cut in half, and they're getting close to retirement. And most of all, we've started this deleveraging. Subprime was just the first thing. Economists are acting like, oh, this is a subprime crisis. We lent to people who couldn't afford houses. No, that's 3 to 4%. Now you already have prime loans are catching up with subprime. Tons of people in this country, good, middle class, upper middle class, affluent people, bought homes that doubled in 5 years. And that happened around the Western world, doubled, in some cases tripled or quadrupled, and banks lent against them like that was solid as rock. Real estate is coming down, it's going to continue down, and it's going to wreck the banking system, and you're going to have the prime crisis, you're going to have the credit card crisis, commercial real estate crisis, and Europe's getting ready to have a round of crisis with East European countries failing. So this banking deleveraging is not over. We have $17 trillion, way more than the U.S. deficit or all consumer debt, $17 trillion alone just in the financial sector leveraging investment. It is absolutely nuts.
So is there some kind of denial going on? Because I got to tell you something. You know, it strikes me as interesting, two things, two particular sectors, aside from real estate, aside from the commercial REITs, there are two sectors that it's been a head-scratcher, and that has been the dining and the restaurants, and it has been retail, which have been inordinately, for the most part now, have been really, really strong. There's some pockets of...
Yeah, except on the high end.
Right, you're right. I
was in Neiman's yesterday catching their sale, and boy, they were so dead. The guy said, I made their day, you know?
Right.
And high-end restaurants, that's the very high-end, but you're right. I go around the malls. I go to, you know, Macaroni Grill and these everyday, you know, chain restaurants. They are packed.
Which is kind of...
But it's because people are cutting their spending. They're cutting radically on housing. They're not buying cars. Those are the big-ticket items. They still have money at this point to spend on the everyday items. And people don't yet, I mean, people did see, the polls were showing, and people are always wrong, so this was helpful to us as well, were showing in the latter part of 2008 that most people did think we're going in the Great Depression. Now the polls that show people think we're coming out of this and we're going to be okay, and they're wrong both ways. We didn't go into the Great Depression in 2009, and we said that in our book. We wouldn't hit the Great Depression until 2010-11. Now people think we're coming out of it, and by late this year and early next year, mark my words, this thing's going back down. The next bank crisis is going to hit, the next geopolitical crisis. We damn near got a civil war going in Iran right now.
I know. I hear you.
What's that going to do to oil prices? You know, I mean, you know, and when we've got a geopolitical cycle that is, you know, points down from 2001 to 2019, and within that cycle, there's these nice little 8.5-year waves where terrorism and geopolitical tension surge. Early 93, you had a bombings in India and in Wall Street, the trade centers, and then you had 9/11 8.5 years later, and we are due for the next, I don't know what it's going to be, but the next crisis of some type in the next 6 to 12 months by that cycle. So, I mean, we see a lot of things could go wrong. The big thing is that baby boomers have turned the corner. They're not going to be spenders anymore. They're going to be savers. The government's going to try to stimulate into a generation that's not going to want to spend, and now they're scared to death seeing all this stuff happen. I mean, when in your lifetime do you see major banks failing and major companies like General Motors just flopping over like nothing? It's scary.
So let's contrast this with Japan, because Japan has been an interesting place. I mean, we went back and looked at Japan for the last, I don't know, 20-something, even 30 years. I mean, if you look at the valuation differential between the Nikkei back then and now, it's off 70% or some ridiculous number. I mean, we're talking about 20-something years
19
ago.
19 years later, it's still down over 70%. Right. It was down 80% at the worst. Real estate, even more so. I mean, the biggest denial around the country, people know stocks can go up and down violently, but people have seen real estate go up all their life, and that is not representative of history. We've been in a unique time. Japan's real estate peaked in 1991, 1 year after their stock market. It went up 2.5 times in 5 years, bubbled even more than we did. We doubled in 5 years in the United States, and it's come down 63%, and it bottomed a few years ago, but it still isn't coming back because now old people, who there's more of them, old baby boomers, are selling their homes to move into nursing homes or die, and offsetting the next young generation that's simply not as big. So real estate's been dead for 18 years. Stocks have been dead for 19 years. And people think, oh, stocks will come back and real estate will come bouncing back. This is a long-term downturn. In fact, this is not just the peaking of the baby boom here. It's not just the peaking of a huge housing bubble and leverage cycle. It is the slowing and aging of all Western society, all Western countries, Europe, East Europe, Russia, United States, Australia, New Zealand, and also Japan and China and South Korea. And we're all aging and slowing down. We're not going to see growth. All the growth is going to be in Asia and countries more like India in the future.
So let's talk about let's go from Japan. Which again, let me ask you one more question about Japan. Japan seems to be on a tear. Now again, that could be just a technical issue. I'm talking about the markets. It could be a technical issue. I look at the P.E. ratios of Japan. Do you know what it says on my Bloomberg terminal next to the P.E. ratio of Japan?
It's got to be high because earnings are down so much.
N.A.
Yeah, sorry, which we need to calculate.
I cannot be calculated. What is going on? I mean,
When earnings, I mean, Japan is not only has a continually weak economy because they're the most aging nation in the world. Italy is number two, and I think Russia and Poland and some others are not far behind that in most of Western Europe and Southern Europe. But you know, they've got slow demographics, but they also, their exports have collapsed with all this decline, and most exporting countries are down strong, and Japan depends on that more than the U.S. So, you know, their earnings are down strong on top of weak demographics, and so it's not that useful to judge P.E. ratios in the early stages. As markets really get down to a bottom, though, you should see price-earnings ratios more in the 5-8 range, and we certainly haven't hit that in the U.S. yet or most countries. But the biggest thing is that people, as you said originally, are in denial. I was just in Australia, where real estate prices have held up later. They barely escaped a recession because they have high immigration, much less of a decline in demographics, strong exports to countries like China. Then China's still growing, even in this slowdown. So real estate is just starting to fall there, and it was just like talking to people in Miami in 2004, 2005, when our newsletter was just ringing the bells on this real estate bubble, and then it was going to collapse. We told everybody in Miami we knew nobody could get it. It's just like, no, real estate doesn't go down. Mm-hmm. They're not making any more of it. There's the Everglades over here. Mm-hmm. There's the ocean over here, and they're having to build condos higher, and everybody wants to move here because we're hot. It is the hot places that mm-hmm. bubble, mm-hmm. like Tokyo, and it's the hot places that collapse. Mm-hmm. Dallas never bubbled, and it'll never collapse. And Dallas will probably go down 20-30%. Dallas has been growing just as fast as Florida. The difference is Dallas has plenty of land. They say in Dallas you can watch your dog run away all day. That's
right.
A joke there.
Well, they also have oil, which doesn't hurt.
So it's the bubble. The people in the bubble places think we're so hot, we're so attractive, we can't go down. Those are the people that ought to be terrified. And I'm sure if you'd have gone over to Japan in 1989 and said, guess what, real estate can fall. In Japan, banks in the late 80s, even though they're more conservative than we are as a culture, they would lend to anybody, any company against real estate because their point of view on that limited rock island with 40 million people in one damn city is that real estate could never go down, and it collapsed more there than anywhere in the world. Now, I just saw a chart the other day from a guy I met in Australia, a professor there, had the same point of view as me there, and everybody over there thinks he's a nut. And I was telling the media, no, you better start listening to this guy. But he showed me a chart from Amsterdam back to the 1600s. And the real estate, 1600s up to 1950, the real estate swings were enormous. Mm. I mean, 80, 90% from top to bottom. Mm. We have this perception that real estate just goes up steadily. The one thing, and it goes down, it always comes back. That's just because we've had this giant baby boom generation ever since World War II. Driving prices up. Now this is ending, and you're going to see big swings in real estate around the world. Japan was 63% down. We're projecting 55% down from the top in the U.S., you know, something like 50 in Australia, and then, you know, places like Spain and Ireland are even worse. So this is a worldwide real estate bust, and real estate is the biggest collateral of banks, and banks are leveraged 10-to-1 on loans. So the banks are going down. The government may seem to save the banks for now, but mark my words, next year or two, you're going to see the commercial real estate crisis hit, and then the prime crisis hit, and then the credit card crisis hit. And, you know, and then business loans, which haven't been hit as bad yet. I mean, this thing is not over.
So let me ask you, I have so many things I want to ask you about China, I want to ask you about immigration, but I want to ask you about what you just said with regard to all these things that have happened, the credit card issue, the commercial real estate issue. When I say that I am up on this stuff, I mean, I am following this like a hawk, okay? And I am very clear, I think that the credit card crisis is kind of close to being here already, but, you know, that commercial real estate clearly is going to be large, the option arm, all that, very, very big. But I think there's a sense somewhere that's kind of percolating around that we know that. And by the way, most people do know that. We know this is going on. And that since we know that, the government is going to, U.S.-based, is going to protect, is going to get the back of. Because we look at the banking situation. I got to tell you something. I look at it with an absolute skeptical eye because that stress test, I don't know what you feel about that, but that stress test was baloney. It was marketed so that they could raise the opinion of the banks to get the private capital in into the banks. Therefore, that was the easiest way to do it, make them look like they were good. And if we look at Citigroup's earnings this quarter, they said there was going to be good earnings. If you strip out all the accounting measures and you strip out all the funny things they did to their books with regard to special income issues when they can take it from loan differentials, things that were just initiated, they actually had a $2.5 billion loss. But yet, we're all giddy about the banks.
No, I mean, they're in total denial. The government's in denial about it. And here they do this stress test. Okay, now how many people, let's say we go back a year before this crisis set in, and let's say, okay, we said, okay, we're going to have a recession, we're going to have 8, 9, 10% unemployment. How many people would have predicted that housing prices would go down 40%
right.
or 50%?
Yep.
They wouldn't have predicted that. And whatever they put on their stress test, they're not predicting down far enough on these things or the default rates. And they're assuming, oh, well, prime loans won't default. I'm like, prime loans? Loans is going to be the biggest part of the crisis because it's the biggest part of the debt. But what most people don't understand is something I think I said earlier. we've got like about $11 trillion in residential real estate loans and about $3 trillion in other, you know, consumer credit cards and auto loans. You've got $11 trillion in corporate debt. You got about $11 trillion growing fast in federal and government debt. But you got $17 trillion just in banks, investment banks and brokerage firms. This is just leveraging investments. And this is the stuff that was causing the meltdown. This is the reason oil prices went from $147 to $32 in a matter of months. I have never, ever in my life seen any market go down that fast. In that short a period of time. I mean, the 87 crash was fast, but it wasn't a 70% drop, you know. And even in the Great Depression, stocks didn't drop 70% in 3 months. It took 3 years to drop 87%. So this was hedge funds just dumping. It's like diarrhea, just dumping everything they had because they're leveraged to the hilt. And they got to meet these margin calls. Well, the government came in and saved the day, just like they did with long-term capital in the 1998. The government's doing this at great expense, you're not going to be able to do it forever. This leverage will be forced out of the system. That $17 trillion is the real danger, because every time we have a problem in the economy and loans go bad, like in the real estate sector, that bubbles over, and all these people who invested in all these mortgages and leverage stuff and all, then these hedge funds and investment managers get hit, and they start dumping, and then you have the next crisis. So we have way more debt. There's $52 trillion in debt in the United States if you add it all up. And if you count unfunded, which is real, unfunded health care, Medicare, Social Security, the same thing that a corporation would have to declare for unfunded pensions, if you did count that in the U.S. government, that's another $43 to $54 trillion by two different estimates. You're talking $100 trillion in debt in a $14 trillion economy.
Again,
that's
these
the
numbers
problem.
Don't make any sense.
This is going to delever, and once it starts, it's so powerful. I mean, what is $4 trillion in government stimulus against that sort of deleveraging and debt? We lost $13 trillion just in household net worth in the last year because of this across-the-board crash. What's $4 trillion in government stimulus compared to that?
I don't know. I mean, the thing is, I'm trying to wonder two things. Number one, what will be the next catalyst? Because first of all, there's some other issues that are going on here that I find very interesting. For example, outside of the economic discussion, you know, there's a lot of people, a lot of managers, money managers, hedge fund guys that either dumped, had to get out, but didn't get this big upside. You know, it's one thing it's one thing not getting hurt in the downside. It's another thing not capitalizing on the upside. Trust me when I tell you, you know, we've been through this over the years. You know, you could save a lot of money, but when you don't make that money on the upside,
people leave you.
Very, very difficult. And the thing is that, you know, we've been fortunate that, you know, we're kind of even for the year, down a little bit for the year. For our portfolios, and depending on which portfolio we look at. But the thing is that, you know, we saved. We didn't lose money last year to speak of. And that's good news because we have, you know, clients have a long-term view.
Yeah,
they get the point.
That's a big deal because almost everybody got smacked.
Right, we didn't get smacked. I mean, we had a couple of guys here or there, but nothing major. I mean, very, very light depending on the positioning. But what's interesting is that, you know, right now there seems to be this kind of belief, I think, that, first of all, I don't know, we can go on forever, but that you know, up forever, but we know that's not possible. But I think what's happening is that a lot of managers that are totally out of the market right now, or mostly out of the market right now, when it comes down to a point, if it comes down to 880, 850, 820, 800, I don't know what the number is. Okay, that's the number I'm going to buy in at. I'm not going to miss this again. And the question is, does that set up a couple of floors on the way down if it does go that direction?
Well, I think the problem is a lot of these guys don't get in the first place because this market has never corrected as much as a normal bull market would, which is also a sign that it's a bear market rally. When you look at the bull market, even the last one back that started in October 2002, the markets came up and they almost retested the lows, you know, several months later. And then they came up late in that year and then they pulled back for several months. I mean, bull markets go up in staircases and then correct. That's healthy. Bear market rallies are just a lot of short covering from people that got overly short in the last bottom. They kept shorting more and more and more. They don't believe it's real when it turns around, so they don't sell it first. Or these hedge funds, like you say, look for confirmation and they wait for a pullback to get in. Well, you know what? The market never pulls back enough for them to get in, so they never get in. And then when it starts going down, they're like, well, you know, the hell with this. So, yeah, there will be some support on the way down at these levels. There always is. We're very clear that this is a bear market rally and that we're going to go lower next year. Our most important cycles did not turn down in 2008. They turned down from late 2009 into late 2010 across the board. We're clear that the markets are going to crash again. What I'm not clear about is whether it kind of starts slowly later this year and then builds up and crashes, or whether we just, you know, start heading back strongly down this fall. I mean, it could happen either way. We're telling people this bounce is likely to go higher, maybe not a lot higher, somewhere like 9,650, 9,800, maybe 10,000 plus, but we're saying somewhere between late July and late August, get the hell out.
That's a lot higher. That's 10% higher from here, approximately.
In other words, it's kind of too late. You know, the market's pull. We're going to give a second buy signal if we get to, you know, at 82.25 or lower and say, okay, but this is a short-term buy signal. This may last a month or two at most. Normally when you get a bear market rally, you get a first strong surge, you get a pullback like now, and then you get a second surge that usually is not as high or strong. So, yeah, we're looking at maybe going 10% higher than this. That's too much risk. If I wasn't in the market, I would consider just staying in cash because, yeah, it goes up there, and then, you know, the downside is horrendous. If we go back to as high as 10 and then go to 2 to 4 next year, which is our kind of target range, I mean, that's just too much downside to be mm-hmm. worth doing in this market for an extra 10% on the upside in case it decides, you know, in case we get a civil war in Iran or something like that and decides to turn down early.
So let's talk about two things. So immigration. I read an interesting story this week or last week about immigration. In other words, one of the big factors with real estate and the growth of America and jobs that were being taken over time was you know, immigrants would come to the land of milk and honey, and they'd come here to prosper, and they'd come and they'd in droves to, you know, work and then send money back home and get a house, et cetera, et cetera. And there's an interesting phenomenon going on that we're actually seeing a reverse immigration right now. I don't know how long that lasts and if it lasts, but where people are picking up and leaving. There's no more opportunity. They feel that, you know, they're going back home. They don't want to do it. They're not going to buy. These are the people that were buying houses. These are the people that are buying cars. These are the people that were consuming. And it's contracting dramatically. Is this something you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, we've been predicting this top roughly for 20 years. That, you know, we have a 46-year lag on the birth index adjusted for immigration for the peak spending of generations, and said, look, somewhere around 2008 or 9, this economy is going to turn down, and it's not just going to turn down for a year or two, it's going to turn down until the early 2020s. In fact, in the great boom ahead, we said the next Great Depression will set in between 2008 and 2023. That was, you know, a decade and a half ago. We've also said from the beginning that immigration will plummet. This is an innovation, an immigration and innovation-driven boom, much like the early 1900s when we attracted scads of immigrants. But it slowed down in the roaring 20s, and just like it slowed down in this decade. People are starting to fight at Lou Dobbs, and we've been predicting immigration will drop to near zero. Mm. And that's what happened in the early 30s. When unemployment goes up and the opportunities go down, both, I mean, the immigrants don't want to risk going over the border anymore, and more important people here say, hey, don't slow it down. Stop it. We cannot afford to give up one job. And you know what? I didn't want to do landscaping shit, but I'm unemployed and I will do landscaping now. I will be a nanny now. So I don't want to compete with a Mexican for that job. So immigration is going to continue to plummet the next few years. And it won't come back. People will be anti-immigrant for a long time.
So what about China? Now, here's the
deal. Which is too bad, because immigration is good for us.
Yeah, of course it's good.
All Western countries are slowing. Yep. We need to have more babies, and we need more immigrants.
Let's talk about China for a second. You know, everybody's looking at China, and they're saying, wow, there is the new world. I mean, there is the new, you know, thing. And Chinese, the China markets have gone up.
Yeah, I mean, if you got a gas mask, it's the new world. You don't mind looking at rivers with fish floating up. Yeah.
Well, here's what's interesting.
Brown and yellow.
By the way, we just canceled a trip to China. My wife said, you know what? They're taking people off the plane for the swine flu, and you don't see your family for a few days. You know, maybe that's not the place we want to go. But here's the question I have. It seems to me that China put in this, I think it was about $550 billion stimulus package back in November.
Which is huge for their economy.
Huge. And that's what I think is interesting to note, is that money spends differently over there, right?
Well, and they're spending it mostly on infrastructure, which they need, number one. I mean, China's a mixed story. We should step back a minute. China, has had some of the strongest demographics in the world for obvious reasons, all their population, but they stopped having kids by policy in the early 70s, which is going to catch up to them in the next 5 to 10 years. Their demographics is going to peak, and they're going to start aging like Japan and Europe, and most people aren't aware of that. So, but they still have upward slope, at least for the next 5 and to somewhat the next 10 years. The second part is that when a country like China gets on a development path, and that's a big deal, you have to do it. I mean, you know, England did it back before the Industrial Revolution, and everybody followed. You start to urbanize and industrialize, that their GDP per capita starts to follow urbanization. Now, China's still, I think at this point, a little under 50% urbanized, and most countries don't peak out until about 80. So China will still have some decades of growth from urbanization, but its demographics will work against it. So in this decade, China is still going to be the leader and going to be the comeback kid. But starting in the next decade, from 2020 on, South Korea, China, Japan, Singapore, the real engines over there of East Asia are all going to be aging and pointing down demographically. So it compromises, and that leaves the real lead to come from a country like India and some other Southeast Asian countries who are lower urbanized and have much stronger and younger demographics for many decades to come. So China's is the paradox. They've grown very fast. The government has driven growth, which you need in the early stages, whereas India hasn't been as aggressive and just catching up. But China is almost overgrown on steroids. They have unbelievable environmental problems, and they have a society that's going to age faster than the United States. Can you imagine that? That China, this young new country, is going to age and be older than the average person in the United States? That's not good. Aging is not good.
Yeah, I hear you. Listen, as I lift my arm and it hurts, I understand that. But listen, in terms of China, the stimulus package is spending, I mean, I read some unbelievable statistics, again, depending on how much we can believe of this, but let's assume we do. I mean, like 127,000 miles of road have already been laid since the November stimulus package, and just the numbers are just extraordinary in terms of the infrastructure.
Roads and railways, which is a really good thing for them to do. I mean, those sort of things, since they're urbanizing, if they were already 80% urban and old, and then some of these infrastructures might be overkill, but they're still urbanizing. So those, I mean, to me, if you want to try to offset a downturn as a government, don't bail out companies and banks and things like that. Give them short-term loans at best so they can restructure intelligently. But don't become investors in that. Put in infrastructures like we did in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. Put in dams and roads, because these things do pay off over time, and you can utilize unemployed people at the, you know, affordable wage. I mean, the pharaohs used to do this way back in ancient times. People think, you know, Martians built the pyramids or something. What happened was they'd get these droughts or depressions or downturns, and they would just go have people come from the countryside, and it was an honor to come and build the pharaoh's pyramid, and they would just get room and board.
Yeah, well, it's interesting.
And it was a win-win. You take unemployed people doing nothing anyway, and you build something of long-term value. I mean, what would Egypt? I mean, the pyramids are the biggest attraction of Egypt. It's the pyramids.
Still, still to stay.
Even now,
they're still getting tourist traffic from it, right?
Yeah, they're still getting it from the turn.
But what's interesting is that you know, in terms of the infrastructure, I agree. And we didn't we started along that path with the stimulus package and kind of veered off very quickly. And unfortunately, it's been very well documented that a lot of that is not getting pass through, and the infrastructure build is really not occurring to
the
level.
It gets thrown around all these states and stuff, and people will do their stupid stuff, some good stuff, some bad.
Right.
You know, you really need a dictator to come in here and say, here's what we need to do with this money.
Well, we're getting close
to
that.
Do the right thing, you know?
We're close to that. But in terms of China, so here's the thing. When I looked at the retail sales last month, there was like a 25% increase in some areas of retail sales. And the number one area of retail sales last month in growth was jewelry. Now, I'm kind of saying, wait a minute. We got a country that still has a lot of, listen, they still have some problems there, that most of the engine is running because of the stimulus bill. We know that. Exports are still pathetic. You know, drop-offs are dramatic, really dramatic. There's still a discussion that they're not out of the woods yet, but jewelry sales are up. And it seems to me that that signals that we're overheating. In addition to that, the loans that are going out to build to buy new houses, and we all know, they said it, they dropped the requirements. The banks there are a little upset because they dropped the requirements in terms of who can get loans, etc. The loans that they've given out have I think they're historic levels at this point, and people are buying jewelry. I mean, does that, in a way, it seems to be a little overheating going on there?
Yeah, I mean, well, part of the reason, I mean, jewelry is a natural thing, because what you have there is a rising middle class, and middle class over here means, you know, 30,000 per capita salaries, or 50,000 per family. Over there, middle class is like 5 to 10,000.
Right.
Cost of living's over there, and you can't afford a Mercedes as a middle class person, but you can show off with a little jewelry. So I can understand that jewelry would be a kind of a rising trend. But yes, it does show that they're kind of in denial too. Here we are in this worldwide crisis, and 35% of China's economy is exports, and they're trying to stimulate domestic demand. But hey, their export industries are where the most profitable jobs come from. And they're the industries that attract these people to migrate in from the countryside and move to cities and urbanize. So, China will, I think, lead out of this, but they're going to go down again, too. I mean, this next phase will bring reality to China. And I agree that it's natural for them to come out of it, and they've got strong stimulus, and the government has the reserves to afford it, and they need the infrastructure. But the truth is they've had a bubble over there, and they kind of need to deleverage and come back to reality as well, and then nobody wants to do that. No junkie wants to come off the heroin because it's painful.
Right.
But your only choice is to keep taking more heroin until you die or just become dysfunctional. And so that's what's happening. Governments around the world don't understand that after a bubble boom like this, and a lot of good things come out, all the innovations of the future and new companies came out of this, so it's not a bad thing. But you have to deleverage after that sort of bubble and get all this debt and excess real estate costs so that products and real estate and goods and services can become affordable again and expand more mainstream. It's part of a process that's natural. And what the government wants to do is say, no, we can't have this. We can't have the banks break down. We can't have big companies fail. We can't have rising unemployment. We can't have real estate values go down. No, that's exactly what happened in the 30s, and that's why we had the greatest mass prosperity boom in Western history in the 40s, 50s, and 60s to follow. The Great Depression brought great efficiencies and rang a lot of excesses out of the roaring 20s economy, which was highly innovative and dynamic and caused all the great companies to emerge. But it needed that phase. It's like winter that clears the decks for spring. And most people's favorite season is spring. It's mine. And that's what comes out of this. But if you don't go through the deleverage, I mean, Japan really didn't allow it to happen. The government debt simply rose and offset the deleveraging of the private debt. So the Japanese are still in more debt than they were before the downturn. We came out of the Great Depression markedly lower in debt in the United States. And it really was a good thing long term. We got rid of a lot of private debt. And back then, the government didn't have all this Keynesian bullshit that tells them they're supposed to offset the entire downturn and take over all the debt of the private sector. That's not what it's about.
So what are the
free
countries?
Markets, let companies innovate,
right.
Let them race for leadership, and then wipe out 9 out of 10 of them and leave the strong ones and get rid of all the debt.
So what countries, aside from us in the Great Depression time or post-Depression, what countries had a better model to get themselves out, out of this either the debt issue or the recession, rather than the government taking on more and more debt and causing greater problems long term? Is there any models?
Well, I really think we, by accident, did the right thing in the 30s. We didn't stop the meltdown at first. We let it happen, and a lot of loans went bad, and a lot of banks, and a lot of debt got destroyed. And then once that deleveraging had happened, Roosevelt didn't walk in like Obama at the beginning of the downturn. He walked in March of 1933, 7 months after the stock market had made its all-time low forever forward, and right as unemployment was peaking at the highest levels ever at 25%, this guy could have gone to sleep and the economy would have recovered. The deleveraging was already over. At that point, you go and invest in infrastructures and you bring some stimulus to the economy and you give people hope and you got a basis for turning around. The problem is the deleveraging process is just starting, and what the government's doing is trying to suppress it instead of letting the free markets do its thing. Everybody's saying the free markets have failed. I say, no, we've just seen one of the greatest innovations and boom periods in history, and now we need to delever for it and come down so that we can bring this stuff more mainstream and bring the cost of living down again. Yeah. It's gotten ridiculous. The U.S. really did the best thing, and now everybody thinks, no, you're supposed to do something different. Japan played it as poorly as possible. They put off the deleveraging. They were in denial about the excess real estate. They're in denial about bank loans. They took very long time to work it out. And the Japanese ended up coming out of the crisis, as I said earlier, with more total debt, mostly now in the government. They have an aging society with fewer and fewer young people to support more and more old people, which is horrible. And they have their government debt is the highest in the world, 190% of GDP. That is a recipe for disaster. Japan is dying. Nobody's just announced. They just haven't announced
the funeral. Yeah, well, I mean, we see the same thing in England, 100% GDP of debt.
Yeah.
And again,
and growing sharp. We started at 60. We're going to be at that. We had $5 trillion before Bush came in the war. Now we got, you know, 10, 11 coming into this crisis. We're going to have 20 by the time Obama probably gets kicked out of office, even though he tried to do the right thing. And we could have 20, 25, 30 trillion in debt before we come out of this long term. That starts your budget process. As it say, oh, we got a trillion and a half of interest, and now we add defense and education, healthcare. I mean, it's absurd.
Yeah, that's another thing. I mean, I don't know how we're going to do all this, how we're going to pay off for all this. It just seems to be a great idea.
The economists think we're just going to come right back and grow at 4% or 5% a year and work all this stuff off. They don't realize that the largest generation in history is getting set to spend less and save more. And again,
how come they don't understand this,
horses, we say all the king's horses, all the king's men will right. not be able to put Humpty Dumpty back together. These guys are in total denial. They don't understand long-term trends in the economy and seasons and stages. They don't understand demographics. They're just thinking, oh my gosh, oops, we screwed up and didn't regulate the banks. They went nuts, and if we fix them, it's all over. There's too much debt to fix anyway, but secondly, even if they did, even we never had a banking crisis and none of this bubble stuff happened, our economy would still slow in the next 12 to 14 years because of massive slowdown in baby boom spending without enough echo boomers to offset them. That simple. It would have slowed anyway.
Right. I mean, the interesting thing is that
we've been predicting this for 20 years that the economy would slow.
Well, hopefully they'll, you know, there's a lot of hope going around here. And there's a lot of, that's what I think.
Yeah, and that's the sort of stuff you short into. Not yet.
Yep.
But exactly. And I was speaking with another guy at, you know, some conference, and he said the fact that people have so much hope around Obama is a crystal clear sign that we're at the beginning of this process and not the end. You don't have hope at the bottom of something like this. In the early 30s, nobody wanted to touch a stock again. Nobody thought they'd ever have a job again. You know, this is not a bottom.
Well, this actually happened pretty fast also. I mean, the down to the up, and well, if it's a down, we'll see a V because that's the way it goes. Do you think that we're going to actually have positive GDP by the end of the year?
Yes, we could, but it won't last long. I mean, we're going to see more crises set in. I mean, again, this meltdown of all these toxic mortgages and these failing subprime loans, it came out of nowhere, and it came fast. It is like diarrhea. I mean, that's why they call it toxicity. It's what the body does. So
I hear you.
We're going to see more of this. Yes, we are going to recover. The government's put enough stimulus, enough Viagra here that you got to get something happening here. But it's not what we're saying unequivocally. It's not going to last. We've started a deleveraging process. We've started a slowing of baby boom spending and rising saving that is not going to stop. And Japan already tried to do the same thing. Massive stimulus year after year, and the economy went down, and real estate deflated 63%, and stocks eventually went down 80%. All they did was drag the process out and run their debt up, which is terrible. They did the wrong thing.
I hear you. Well, everybody, I would like you to listen to my friend here. He's got some good thoughts, and I think that he's been right on for a while. Again, you know, the question is, when does it all kind of come to a ball? And I'm hard-pressed. There is one thing, and I think we all know this kind of deep down. I'm hard-pressed to really believe that, you know, this whole thing, which is supposed to be the worst situation since the Great Depression, and even if we want to say it's equal to the 70s, if we do want to say that, you know, it's kind of weird that the markets seem to be reacting so positively and our economy can come back so fast, you know, considering this is supposed to be this unbelievable event with the numbers that with a lot of more zeros than we've ever seen. And it seems kind of illogical, just illogical to me.
It's a classic bear market rally. The depression started, and it happened in a shorter period of time, but depression, the first crash in late 29, was a 50% correction in the market. And then from that 50% low, the market bounced 50%, which means it retraced half its losses, and then it turned and then just kept crashing from there. It's classic in the early stages of a downturn to think, oh, this is just a short-term thing and the government's fixing it. I mean, look at what's happened the whole last decades. We have a stock crash, we have a recession, and it's over because baby boomers, you know, turn around and spend more and the government stimulates. Well, this time it's different. We went way too far in debt, and secondly, the baby boomers aren't going to bail us out this time. They're going to drag our ass down as far as the eye can see. That's what people don't get. This is different. So this is a bear market rally. The optimism is not justified, but you know what? Even Warren Buffett is optimistic.
No. Hold on.
The government's done that. No, he doesn't see the green shoots. He thinks the government's done the right thing. That he's been telling people, hey, when stocks are down, buy them. Kirk Kerkorian has lost his ass.
Oh, boy, that's bad.
Because he and Warren Buffett have been the smart money that every time we get a correction and stocks go down and people get scared and think it's over, they step in. Well, the problem is this time they're stepping in too early. And Warren Buffett, he didn't intend to. Becky Quick turned him into this. With all her smiles and stuff. He's now America's economist, and he doesn't have a flying clue what the hell's happening. He doesn't.
I understand.
He's not an economist. He says he never tries to predict the economy, but they have him commenting on the economy now, and people listen to him, and I'm listening to him saying, look, you should have just stuck to investing here. You're the greatest investor in history. Stick to it. Shut up on the economy. You don't have a clue. He doesn't.
I understand. And it, you know what the other thing is very interesting?
He thinks Bernanke's done a great job, and this thing, you know, yeah, it's not going to turn around easy, but he thinks this thing's over, and it's time to buy.
Yeah. Hey, let me just ask one thing, and then we'll close on this. But here's what's interesting. Do you see, or does it seem to you, that this last, I don't know, 3 months, there has been more information that has been thrown around by countries talking about how the problem is solved and the you know, talking about how, you know, adjusting their GDP numbers? I mean, it's like a nonstop train of information that keeps on coming out. It comes out in China overnight, then it comes out in Europe, then it comes out to, and then it rotates.
It's denial. And don't you think these government officials are telling the Warren Buffett, hey, Warren, get up there and talk this up. You know, people respect you. Of course they're saying that. And you know, he's saying, well, I'm happy to do that because I think he believes this is a short-term crisis and not a long-term crisis. But everybody's in denial. And again, over in Australia, gosh, I just had to beat people over the head. I said, look, wake up. You have a worldwide housing crash, and you think you're going to be the one country when you're the most overvalued, second to California, to not have it? You know, like, wake up. Mm. You guys are sitting here in the middle of nowhere. You're too close to the South Pole here. You know, get in the real world.
Right, exactly. Harry Dent, always a pleasure to have you on the Discipline of Investor podcast. Everybody go out and check out his book, The Great Depression Ahead, and I think you'll enjoy it very much. And Harry,
also,
keep up
check out our website. We've got, you know, free samples, our newsletter, and a lot of information, a lot of free downloads. I think I've got a video, you know, download that. We always have a lot of, and a lot of long-term stuff they didn't let me put in the book because it's too long. We just give to people for free on the website.
And what's the website address?
www.hsdent.com.
All right, we'll put a link, of course, on the website. I'll speak to you soon. We'll catch up. And when you're down in this part of the woods, say hello.
Okay, thanks, Andrew.
All right, thanks, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's going to wrap it up today on the Disciplined Investor podcast. Thanks for joining me. We're going to end it right there today because it's the summertime, and you know what? I'm going to spend a little time with the family this weekend. I have two girls that just went to college. I have a boy that just went to camp today, and I got to tell you something. I need a break. I need to rest this weekend. I need to spend a little time with the family. Or what I have left, my wife and I, and we're going to spend a little time going out to a movie tonight. And I thought that I would just try to take a little bit of break. Are you guys in that in there for me? Do you think that's okay? Because I really need it. I have been working nonstop for over a year and a half. Don't feel sorry for me. Just, you know what? Tell me that we're doing it what we can for you. Please, do me a favor. You know what? I could use some pick-me-up emails, to be honest with you, because I am tired. But anyway, don't feel sorry. Just send it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestorpodcast.com. Actually, we'll start again. Send it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'd like to hear about how we've helped you, how we haven't helped you, what you think is good, what you think is bad, your suggestions. Because it's summer, we're going to relax a little bit this summer. Hopefully the markets will relax a little bit this summer. We're going to give you some ideas the best we can. And of course, if you want to see what we're doing in terms of our client management and how we handle things and how we, you know, invest, you can always go to the website. There's a link there to look at the virtual tour for the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. But until next week, thanks a lot. Take a break. Take a rest. Take a breath. It's time to relax a little bit. It's the summer. I'll see you real soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.